You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. This is episode 289. Today, we're going to talk about the mistakes that people make during rehab. Now, the risk of injury from exercise is quite low in comparison to other non-contact sports and pretty similar to what we see in non-exercising adults. That being said, people who exercise do get injured, sometimes in the gym and other times doing other activities. Now, in the gym, the most commonly affected areas are the low back, knees, hips, and the shoulders. But these are common places that non-lifters experience pain as well. Most injuries that occur in the gym are not catastrophic. They typically resolve on their own within a week or two without any sort of medical attention. But regardless of how the pain started, it can still be challenging to deal with in training, especially if it becomes more severe in the day or two after a session or when the pain extends into routine day-to-day activities at home, work, or during sleep. In this podcast, we're going to talk about how to rehab from an injury and the top three mistakes people make when doing it on their own. Dr. Austin Baracchi wrote an article about this, so we're going to summarize that, get into the weeds a little bit. On the other end of the line is the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, dude?
Hey, man. Feeling all right? No concerns at the moment.
No apparent distress?
Yeah. Usual a little bit of some aches and pains here and there as things tend to go in the course of life and training myself. How about you?
Same. Yeah. I think if I woke up one day and was like completely analgesic, whatever the term, you know, hypoalgesia, I would be concerned. I'd be like, is this the end?
Did somebody slip you some ketamine or something like that? Or
did I slip myself some? I don't know. You know, like I thought I was taking, multivitamin. Not that, I was having this conversation with a friend the other day, like what text could you send to somebody to let them know that you're in trouble without like telling them you're in trouble? And I think it would be a number of things. Oh yeah, just took a multivitamin. What up, dog? He'd be like, send the police. I would never. Do you have an idea what you would send me to let me know that you're in trouble and you need my attention to help save you?
Dude, I'm really concerned about my vitamin D level.
Oh my God. Yeah. I'd be like, call the police. Somebody took his phone. He's a Nice. All right. Well, I want to talk about this article and kind of get into the weeds a little bit about the points that you make. But of course, we got to start this with the case. And again, believe it or not, I found a perfect case for this to really describe kind of our thoughts on the rehab process in general and highlight some pearls. So, Dr. Baracchi, a 21-year-old male presents to your clinic with a 6-year history of bilateral knee pain. He denies trauma or an acute injury, either before or recently, and reports symptoms develop gradually over a number of months. He says the pain is worse when going up or down stairs, standing up from a chair, and sitting longer than 30 minutes with his knees bent. He used to play a lot of sports, but has stopped over the past few years based on advice from his doctors to avoid activities that cause pain. He was seen 4 years ago by orthopedic surgery, who diagnosed the patient with osteochondritis dissecans, which is when a segment of the bone and cartilage starts to separate from the rest of the bone after repeated stress or trauma. At the time, x-rays were normal, and the patient was referred to PT. Previous physical therapy involved lower limb stretching, band-resisted exercises, and foot insoles. He says none of this really helped. He wants to get back into swimming and cycling, but he's afraid of making whatever is wrong in there worse and the pain getting worse as a result. He takes tramadol and acetaminophen as needed for pain. And on exam, I just want to give you this right off the bat so you can kind of work through this. He's a well-nourished young man, no apparent distress, sitting on the exam table. His vital signs were normal, so we just did a focused lower body exam. So no apparent trauma, no swelling, no bruising or apparent deformity. His full range of motion, although he does have mild pain at end range of knee flexion. There's no tenderness to palpation over the patella, over the quadriceps tendon or patellar ligament. There's no joint line tenderness, and he has 5 out of 5 strength in the quadriceps and hamstrings. Repeat x-rays of both knees are normal. So we moved on to some functional testing. He could do active straight leg raise without pain. Single leg balance was also fine. He could squat to 90 degrees of knee flexion, although he does report a small amount of pain on the front of his knees. Although the sideways step-down test, basically stepping down from an elevated surface, caused moderate pain, which was resolved by placing a finger on the wall for support. He had no pain after testing. So when taking all of this into consideration, what comes to your mind?
Yeah. So I guess we can take this similar to our recent case studies. And a pattern that you may have heard in the previous ones is before I even hazard guesses at diagnoses, I try to kind of summarize the general problem that we're trying to solve here. And so if I could take everything that you told me, I'd say we have this 21-year-old healthy male with chronic, symmetric, bilateral, non-traumatic, and non-inflammatory knee pain. There are various features that you told me that kind of led me to add each of those like semantic qualifiers there, because each of those kind of narrows what I'd be thinking. And he has a super benign exam. Some things that surprised me a little bit, I kind of expected him to have a little bit of some tenderness over the patella, but he doesn't. That the x-rays are normal is great. Even if they were a bit abnormal, that may or may not really heavily influence my thinking, depending on what's seen. And so overall here, you know, we've talked on some of these previous recent episodes about how I think about joint pain. Now we have bilateral symmetric joint pain, again, in the absence of trauma, in the absence of inflammatory findings like swelling or fevers or redness, things like that. And it's been going on for a very long time. And then when noting his provocative factors, mainly when he talks about getting worse, going up or downstairs, standing up for a chair, sitting longer than 30 minutes with his knees bent, those are kind of characteristic descriptors. Sometimes in the setting of certain types of tendinopathy, that can be those can be provocative sorts of situations. But most of the time, and accounting for this patient's exam findings, this will get labeled as what's called just patellofemoral, you know, knee pain or patellofemoral syndrome, which is just a fancy doctor term of just calling this, yeah, you got knee pain. And so that's ultimately, you know, I don't think that we need to chase this a ton further at this point in terms of very, very, very specific, you know, structural type diagnoses. We've talked on previous episodes about the utility of that sort of thing, mainly when if I were to make a particular structural or tissue specific or medical diagnosis, it would lead me to do something very different with the patient. For example, if I thought he had infections in his joints, then just giving him a rehab plan isn't going to help that, right? If he has an autoimmune disease that's eroding away his joints, like then that's another thing that just plain old rehab isn't going to solve. Or if he had, you know, crystals depositing in his joints from gout or various other types of periarticular things, problems going on around the joint that might need dedicated, you know, targeted treatment from a medical standpoint, a surgical standpoint, or otherwise, then those would be diagnoses I'd want to make. But at this point, you know, his physical therapy that he's been exposed to, although we got relatively little detail about it, I'm not super impressed by in terms of him having some lower limb stretching and some foot insoles and things like that. So I'd want to, you know, probably approach this maybe a little bit differently. But I don't think that we need to chase very advanced diagnostics at this point just yet. Now, if this patient was in most clinics and he came in, he said, I've had this for 6 years, I've had a bunch of x-rays before, you know, rehab isn't working, I could see plenty of people sending this patient for knee MRIs. Based on the history, based on the exam, I think it's unlikely that you would find something on the MRI that's like, oh, we really need to do bilateral knee surgery on you or something like that. So I don't think that the utility is going to be very great of that sort of advanced imaging at this point. So that's kind of my overall thought process at this point.
Yeah, I think, you know, this case is unfortunately not uncommon. We get similar stuff to this, not only with our pain and rehab team, but also in our Facebook groups, on our forum. You know, people will have this long, drawn out history of pain, not due to any particular recent trauma, maybe a previous trauma, a previous incident or something like that. It just never really got better. And many of these folks, if they've sought out medical care, will have been referred to physical therapy. And if they went to the physical therapy, will say, yeah, it didn't work for me, right? It's like a failure of physical therapy. It's like, well, that's like saying exercise didn't work for you. It's like maybe that particular flavor of PT didn't work for you, a particular dose or whatever they were doing wasn't appropriate or sufficient to help you out. So we hear this all the time, but I agree with you based on the, you know, presentation so far, you're not thinking about something nefarious that requires an extensive medical workup. If, you know, you referred this patient to one of our physical therapists, one of our pain and rehab specialists, and so you're pretty sure that they're getting adequate care, you know, an adequate sort of flexibility with the plan to address their signs and symptoms, and they still didn't get better, you know, after a number of weeks, I could see a case for kind of not only revisiting the workup from the physical exam standpoint and what, you know, maybe getting a more extensive history, but also additional imaging and getting more specialists on board. But I'm just not satisfied with how they've been managed so far. In particular, the labeling of the patient with this osteochondritis desiccans sort of diagnostic label, which I imagine how that's been explained in the clinic to the patient is that, hey, yeah, some of your bone is like kind of separating. So that's why you have pain. And then in their brain automatically, they're like, well, shoot, what do I do about that?
How is exercise going to help that? Exactly.
It's kind of like saying, you know, osteoarthritis is wear and tear, right? Like, okay. But then the treatment is exercise. And you're like, but wouldn't that cause more wear and tear? In addition to general kinesophobia with the repeated sort of learning of, hey, when I do these activities, I have pain, because there's no approach to like dosing that, finding an entry point, progressing over time. So yeah, unfortunately, this is really common, which allows, it's a perfect segue into the article that you wrote, you know, the most common mistakes people make when rehabbing an injury, again, wherever it occurs, whether it's in the gym or outside of the gym. So we're going to talk about that. So first off, Dr. B, the question that everybody wants to know is, should people train with pain, right? It's like the age old question. Like, I have this pain, should I just rest or should I move? Like, do you have a general take on that idea? Like, if I have pain in a joint, for example, when I'm doing the exercise that I'm supposed to do for the day, should I like keep training or should I pack it in and go home?
Yeah, I kind of view this through three different prongs or three different lenses that I'll work through here. The first is, if the pain, you know, travels with company that leads us to be very concerned, and then that is something where training in the short term is not necessarily the highest priority, but rather getting the medical evaluation should be the higher priority. And examples of those are some of the things that we've seen in some of the recent case studies or case reports that we've talked about for very, very severe, you know, joint pain that has followed a significant trauma to that area, or that is impairing the person's function, ability to use that limb or joint, you know, pretty dramatically. Or if there's any signs or symptoms in the rest of the body that are coinciding with this, for example, like the kid that we talked about who had the shoulder pain and then a fever, and we were worried about a joint space infection, that's not something that you're just going to train through and is going to get better on its own, right? If you start to have multiple different joints cropping up, or these joint pains associated with other symptoms like rashes or, you know, eye changes, urinary changes, ulcers in your mouth, like these are all the kind of things that make me worry a lot more about other medical conditions that need to be diagnosed and treated, because again, that's a situation where the diagnosis matters. But the other kind of two lenses that we can view this through, in the absence of any of those things, if it's this just kind of routine, run-of-the-mill musculoskeletal aches and pains that people experience during exercise, or even after, even if it is after a relatively minor injury, not something super major, catastrophic, or destabilizing, then we have two options. We can either train kind of through/around the pain in a way, and there's some evidence to support this, that rehabilitation, despite or in the setting of tolerable pain symptoms, is for the most part okay, and in some rehab contexts has actually been shown to give better outcomes. Certain situations relating to like hamstring strains and some other things like that, where people can engage the activity even if there's some discomfort. If it's tolerable, they can do just fine, sometimes even better. But I don't want to frame that as the only option for people either, to where people say, well, I have this discomfort and the barbell medicine guy said, I just have to keep training through this or keep training around it and keep beating my head against the wall, even if I'm not getting better. So training through, training around with modifications that we'll talk about in a little bit is certainly an option. And if you kind of proceed through that process in the way that we will recommend, as we discuss it shortly, finding a appropriate entry point and progressing it, you know, appropriately and adjusting as your symptoms kind of wax and wane over time, then that's great if that works well for you. But if you either have trouble finding a tolerable kind of starting point to rehab with exercise involving the painful area, or if you start and then you're not really getting progress, you're not really seeing things desensitize, or, you know, you're just not really getting to where you want to be on a reasonable time frame of expectations, not like I'm gonna get better tomorrow, but over, say, weeks and maybe months sometimes, then it's also perfectly okay to temporarily let the area chill out and pull a particular activity, pull a particular movement, or just spare the area for a period of time. So there's this, you know, there's this debate of like, do we engage the area? Do we protect the area? there's room for both options in people when it comes to making rehab decisions. Now, in this patient that we've just talked about in the opening case, he's had pain for a long time. And he was given advice by doctors just to avoid activities that cause pain. That is oversimplistic and generally bad advice, right? Because as a result, he used to engage in all sorts of activities, and he has gradually progressively withdrawn from one after the next, to the point where you eventually say, well, I'm 21 years old. I guess I'm just getting old and I can't do the things I used to do, right? So, you know, if I do, you know, through a shared plan, you know, working with somebody, say, you know, this is maybe a situation where we want to just actually rest the area. Sometimes that's okay, but with the framing of we're letting this cool off before we can build it back up again with a plan to reintroduce the activities that matter to the person. So those are kind of my big three kind of views on training with pain. The first is thinking about, is there reason to suspect an actual medical, you know, thing that needs distinct management, as all the examples that I gave? Or is this a situation where we can reasonably train with, despite, through, around the discomfort by finding a good entry point and then adjusting our training to respond to how our symptoms wax and wane? Or finally, is this a situation where it's not going to kill me to take a few days off, to take a week off of this particular activity, or to offload this area to let it cool off, with the understanding that I'm going to reintroduce these activities in a, using a similarly intelligent strategy to build myself back up to tolerance again? Those are kind of the big three.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, if someone doesn't have any of those signs or symptoms that, as you said, travel with the, with the pain, so things that would get us worried from a medical standpoint, I think the preference would be if somebody can directly exercise, move, do activities that involve the area. Yep. We would prefer that approach, not only from like general fitness preservation or development, but also just, you're at a higher level, of movement. We don't have to regress nearly as far, right? But if that's not an option, if there's no particular entry point, whether that's due to sensitivity with all movements that are available to you, whether it's a resource type thing, you don't have access to particular machines or equipment that you can find a way to train, or just fear at the time, like, look, it's also fine to regress even further and kind of avoid those things. I wouldn't do that in perpetuity, right? Because then there's no plan coming back. And I should also say, like, that this recommendation, people are going to hear it different ways based on their, not only their own experiences, but kind of like who the individual is. People that are like, yeah, I want to train. How can I train? I need to train. I don't want to lose my gains. These people are going to hear this advice. Oh yeah, you can train with pain. They're like, great. They turn the click off. They're headed to the gym. On the one hand, like, props, like, that's great, you know? But that person, you're going to have to probably pull back from training because they want to go too far. Whereas other people who are either worried, they've been off for a long time, they don't regularly weren't regularly participating in exercise beforehand, they're going to hear this and say, I'm not so sure, right? So it just depends. The advice is going to land differently with different people. So for the latter person, where just the, you know, kind of the green light to go do something, that person, probably you need to start with some open-ended questions about what are their current beliefs about their current injury. How did they get here? What are their limitations? You're going to have to do some education, right? You're going to have to come up with a shared plan on, like, here's where I want you to go. Here's how I think we get there. What are your values? What are you able to do? What are you willing to do? And then probably some early violation or expectation violation. You know, if someone says, I can't really stress my knee in any sort of way, it would be nice if in the office you showed them, like, hey, there's a stress that we can apply to the knee that you don't have, you know, this crippling pain. And they say, huh, okay, well, maybe they're a little more open at that point to doing something with it. That doesn't mean you can always find that stuff in the clinic, especially if you only have a few minutes. I understand the limitations there. But I just want to impart upon the audience that the same sort of advice of generally staying active during a period of injury is going to land differently with different people. And depending on somebody's sort of biases and their beliefs, well, you may have to have additional conversations. Again, the person who's ready and willing to train already, they're already out the door. They're on the way to the gym right now. They're sipping pre-workout. They're ready to go heavy. That person, you might have to temper a little bit compared to the person who probably needs a little more encouragement to get started. So I think that's a good segue into these common mistakes. There's three of them: not reducing the load enough, progressing too quickly with the load. So adding weight back too quickly is the second one. And the third one is not enough movement variation. So let's start off with not reducing load enough. Yeah, we see this all the time, but can you think of an example that you've either dealt with either personally or professionally, where that would really kind of give folks an example of when this happens, just not taking enough weight off the bar?
Yeah, this happens a ton in the context of people who really enjoy training and are motivated to train. That's that former demographic that you were just talking about. Not so much the people who are, you know, generally averse to exercise because they're perfectly willing to stop altogether a lot of the time. But motivated trainees, which include you and I and a lot of the people we've worked with and coach, have all been through this. I know I've done this. I know you've done this. I know some of our lifters and trainees and clients have done this too, where you've been training, whether for a modest amount of time or a long time, but you have built up what you perceive to be some hard-fought gains and some hard-fought progress, and then you experience a bit of an ache, a discomfort, or that you might initially blow off and say, hey, I heard that most of these get better on their own, and a lot of the time they do, but maybe this one doesn't, and it progresses, and it worsens despite you, you know, adding weight to the bar and continuing to make progress to the point where it becomes pretty limiting and not as tolerable as it was before. And because you perceive that, gosh, I've built up all this progress, I'd hate to have to pull way back, and this perception of losing progress or you know, falling back or giving up some of the gains you've made, says, well, okay, well, I've gotten up to this, you know, 400-pound squat or something like that. Let me just back off to, like, I don't know, maybe like 375 or something like that. You take a pretty modest amount of weight off the bar. And maybe that makes it a bit more tolerable during that session, but ultimately it still persists and it doesn't really tend to resolve the issue. And so you just kind of keep taking these little baby steps backwards or trying to stay at the same weight or even trying to build back up again, hoping it goes away on its own. And ultimately just spinning your wheels and not getting anywhere while cementing this issue as, you know, making it more and more and more chronic. In other words, digging yourself into a deeper and deeper hole that's probably going to take you a bit longer to dig out of in the long term than if you had just kind of nipped it in the bud up front. And so, you know, I've personally experienced this when I've, you know, been at my strongest and then some kind of an ache sets in and I'm like, is this something that's going to last? Is it going to go away? How much am I going to have to pull off? I've seen you do the same in certain contexts in the gym. Like, you have this ache and you're kind of trying to work around it, still moving as heavy of weights as you can. But I'm, you know, wondering, is that going to work? Or is he going to ultimately have to pull back more than he wants or change the movements or something like that? So pretty common issue. Does that also reflect what you've seen in practice?
Yeah. And I think it really boils down to an even maybe deeper question. Is like, well, when do you have to actually engage in a formalized, we'll call it, rehab plan? You know, you got to switch a lot of things in order to make some headway. And so, yeah, it's tough to say without a specific context and without sort of feedback, right? Because if I get, you know, a low back tweak, I just have low back pain that kind of came on, or knee pain or whatever, just any sort of pain without any other sort of concerning signs or symptoms. My hope is that, this is like a 1 week deal. If I just kind of take a moderate session instead of, you know, a heavy session, it'll just go away, whatever. Maybe even the weight adjustment was unnecessary. It was just like a time, I just need a week or something to kind of, you know, get over this. That's my hope, I guess. But my litmus test is that if it's going on for multiple weeks and I'm not able to see demonstrable improvement, resolution of signs or symptoms, I'm like, well, this is just going to keep going on, you know, likely. So now it's time to engage in a sort of formalized rehab plan where multiple things are going to have to change, not just the weight on the bar, but also the reps, potentially the movement itself, the tempo of the movement, range of motion of the movement, the implement I'm using, etc. I just kind of, quote, bite the bullet and make a change. That's generally how I go about things. And that's how I do with clients as well. You know, hey, I got this knee pain or whatever. I'm generally maybe more aggressive because I'm like, if this isn't real, meaning that it's, you know, you experience this thing, but it goes away on its own, you know, in a couple of days, then yeah, great. We didn't need to change anything. But so my normal advice is like, let's just see how this goes by the end of the week. We won't change anything unless other signs or symptoms pop up or get worse. In that case, let me know. In that point, I'll bite the bullet and make a larger change. But when it comes time to do that, I need to make sure they take enough weight off the bar, or I need to take enough weight off the bar. If I've decided, I've declared, okay, I'm going to do some sort of focused rehab plan so I don't just keep spinning my wheels, at that point, I need to make sure that they take enough weight off the bar. So therein lies the question, how do you know if you've taken enough weight off the bar? Or perhaps a better question, how do you know if you haven't taken enough weight off the bar? And you come up with three kind of signs here, and I'll let you talk about these, but I'll just list them for the audience. If the pain increases with each subsequent set as the weights get heavier during the workout. If the pain worsens, you know, 24 to 48 hours after the session, or if the pain never returns to the quote baseline level before the next training session, meaning like pain got worse either during or after the training session and never kind of goes back down to what it was beforehand. Those are three indicators, like not enough weight was taken off the bar. Do you have anything else that sort of like tips you off that we just really haven't taken enough weight off the bar just yet?
Yeah, just approaching these situations from the start when I'm having a conversation with somebody, I view most of these non-traumatic lifting related aches and pains. A lot of the time they fall into the category of this person did either too much too soon or more than they have in the recent past than up to now been doing more than they were ready for at that time. And that could be on the end of their programming, be it most of the time intensity, sometimes some volume, sometimes some frequency, whatever the case is. Or maybe a new movement that they weren't adequately prepared for was in excess of their tolerance. Or it may be that they've been doing something similar, but rather their tolerance decreased. Why would somebody's tolerance decrease? A ton of life stress, sleep, you know, disruptions, all sorts of other things that can limit how well you can actually tolerate, recover from, and adapt to, you know, stresses at any given time. So that's kind of like the differential diagnosis that I would view this kind of a problem through, so to speak. And so when I'm talking to somebody and kind of taking a history and trying to get a sense of what's going on, those are some of the questions that I'm getting at. Tell me what your training has looked like recently. What have you been doing? What did you used to do? Was there any change there? And then tell me about the rest of your life and see if things seem well matched or if they seem mismatched in one way or the other. And so if the issue seems to be primarily that the programming is off, it's too much, it's, you know, something super novel that they're still pushing too heavy, then I'm very aggressive with pulling the load back. And then if it's on the, you know, the tolerance side, then we talk about, well, how can we better match the training to your current life circumstances while we work on getting those better, be it your sleep, your stress, et cetera. Maybe we need to put in some load caps or some RPE caps, or maybe we need to de-emphasize, you know, top set intensity or something like that. So we have various strategies to kind of bring that stimulus and that tolerance into better alignment. That would be the goal of a rehab program here. And so when I'm viewing, how do I know if it's too much? This is this first one that you mentioned where pain is increasing with each subsequent set as the weights increase. Somebody goes into warm up and they're lifting the empty bar or the empty dumbbell or the empty sled or whatever, you know, machine exercise they're doing. And then as they do their warm up sets and they increase the load from set to set to set, things are getting worse. Honestly, to me, that's like a do not pass go, this ain't worth it type scenario, right? I don't care what you think, you know, gains you think you're preserving, it is not going to work out the way you want. And so even if the discomfort has been going on a relatively short period of time, and I think it's going to resolve within a week or something like that, that session is probably not worth it to keep pushing through and increasing the weights, right? So if you have this discomfort in an elbow or a shoulder or a knee, and every time you put a little bit more weight on or add a plate to the stack or whatever the case is, it's getting more uncomfortable, like that's a stop situation. Not because I think you're going to damage something worse or because you're, you know, harming. It's just that the goal of that training session is not going to be met by continuing to do that. What is the purpose of what you're doing, right? The purpose of what we're doing with training in general is to try to build these adaptations that we place value on, that we are seeking. Even if we viewed it as a rehab session, what is the intent of a rehab session? Well, it's to help to desensitize the area, to calm it down, as our friend Greg Lehman would say, which clearly we're not doing by pissing it off with each increasing load increment, and then to build it back up, which going through that process of adding load while you're warming up and it's hurting more is also not doing anything to build it back up because it is not in a place, it is not ready to adapt to build back up. So that first scenario is definitely for me like a hard stop one. Not to say you need to stop training, leave the gym, go home and immobilize the area, but rather loading on that exercise, on that session is not the priority. We should either pull the load way back on that movement, or my preference in those kind of scenarios, honestly, is just let's do something different for the day. What do you think about all that?
Yeah. I've started, you know, incorporating sort of, it's like a like in workout algorithm sort of for people like this. And there's different folks that get this sort of programming. Some of these folks will have like issues that are like pain issues, small, relatively mild pain issues, but they come up frequently. Right. And that's usually due to like life stress, whether it's, you know, a lot of work stuff, traveling a bunch, illnesses, what have you. And just it's tough to make a lot of progress when they don't have momentum going because there's always this little setback. And I'm like, man, it'd be nice if I was there and could like, you know, divert change the plan on the fly based on the sort of feedback. And so to your point, I agree that if somebody is developing increased pain during the session or has a lot of pain prior to the session, my expectation is that maybe the original plan for the workout, let's just say it was like 5 sets of 5 at RP 7, you know, which pretty challenging session, that's likely not going to be completed as, you know, with the goal in mind, at least not in a satisfactory way without a lot of collateral damage. Again, not necessarily to the joint, but like to fatigue and fear and again, reinforcing this sort of pain loop, as it were. So in that case, I'd be like, okay, we can either reduce the volume way, way down. You're just doing one set, you know, something like that. Or, you know, if that's a suitable solution, or we can change the movement to like a 303 tempo version with double the reps and a lower RPE stop. The idea is now we've taken weight off the bar. So there are multiple options here. But I think the crux of this question comes down to, and this is mostly directed at folks who are highly motivated to train. They're like, I don't want to take weight off the bar because it's going to limit my gains. Okay, but I need to take enough weight off the bar so that I don't keep like in this endless loop of pain, right? So how do I get to a place where I can work hard, feel like I'm getting something out of the session without shooting myself in the foot? And that's why I think it's important to make other changes to the actual program prescription that allows people to actually work. Hey, I actually took whatever that set was to 2 or 3 reps shy of failure. I felt like I was working hard. It was hard in a different way. You know, but what changes would I need to make? And so in that case, instead of 5 reps at RP7 for a squat with a normal, you know, tempo, it would be 303 tempo squats, sets of 12 at RP, you know, 6. And it's like, okay, because you've increased the rep range, because you've added a tempo a component to this, you've reduced the weight markedly, but you're still taking it to like 4 reps shy of failure. So it feels like you're working pretty hard. It's just hard in a different way. And so I think that's kind of how you, you know, assuage any fears of losing gains, so to speak. And you also kind of give a person who wants to work hard the ability to work hard, but in a non-threatening way and in a way that doesn't exacerbate symptoms. So that's kind of how you're trying to approach this, making sure that it's enough weight on the bar to mentally like get somebody to engage and buy in, but not too much where it kind of keeps people in this loop.
Yeah, I agree. And to comment on one thing you mentioned and add something else, you mentioned one scenario where sometimes people will say, well, I'll just pull back way a lot on the volume and do one like real heavy set. I do not buy that is particularly effective in the vast majority of situations. I know a lot of people who have tried something like that. They say, I've got this tendinopathy. And I heard that like heavy training is good for tendinopathy. So I'm just going to do like, you know, work up to a top set of 3 at like a 9 RPE or something like that and call that good for the day. For lifters, I am pretty skeptical that that is a good strategy. Now, does that mean that it never works? I obviously would never say the things that are that extreme, just like I wouldn't say that this other strategy that we're proposing is always going to work for people either. That's why there are multiple kind of like algorithmic levels to how we intervene on people's training. And the other thing here is like, I wouldn't advise people use analgesics like ibuprofen, naproxen, acetaminophen, certainly in the original case, tramadol, terrible drug, never use it for any reason, to address symptoms, mask symptoms so that you can still train heavier and thinking that you're retaining some strength, because that's also unlikely to result in a good long-term rehabilitative kind of process. So those are some of the additional points there. The other, you know, caveats that we mentioned were if pain worsens in the 24 to 48 hours after a session, this is something you may have experienced where say you have some low back pain and you do your training session and you're like, oh, that training session actually felt okay. But later in the evening or when you go to lie down in bed at night, it's just like throbbing or aching. That's a sign that, hey, I probably did too much for the day and I actually need to get below whatever threshold I have at the moment, such that this doesn't happen in the evening. And then once that goes away, once that stops happening, when you lay down to go to bed at night, you're like, oh, I'm actually making progress, right? That itself is a sign of progress. So those are a few other ways that I think about this when I'm listening to people's symptoms and trying to formulate a plan for them.
Yeah, I agree. The reduction in volume is more of like a cross your fingers and pray and hope that this was actually just like a minor thing that just was going to resolve on its own kind of no matter what you did, as long as you didn't do something really, really silly and piss it off further. That's usually like a one and done type trial. Like, all right, well, let's just try this. And if it works, great. we can just continue as planned otherwise. But if it doesn't work, yeah, then at that point, I'm kind of like, yeah, bite the bullet. It's time for a more legitimate, more extensive rehab plan. So yeah, we're in agreement on that. Okay, so let's move on to the next one, increasing load too quickly. So this assumes that a person has entered a rehab phase for a particular body part or area of the, you know, area, and is actively working through that. They found an entry point with movement modification, so changing to a tempo, partial range of motion. If they need to, changing the implement, so maybe that's using a special bar or a machine, for example. The rep range is higher, all these sorts of things. Second biggest mistake that you list here is increasing the load too quickly. And I can think of a few situations that would lead people down this road. So one, time is like the great equalizer here. A few weeks go by, you're just doing stuff, plotting along, and people are like, hey, I don't actually have this this discomfort anymore. And they're like, so I could just immediately hop back to normal. But the problem here is that there is a simultaneous loss of adaptations if you have not been performing the exercise and the volume and the overall training stress that it comes with all that during this rehab period, plus the increased sensitivity that you recently got over, right? And this desire, like, oh, I just want to like get back to what I was doing. So you put all, that's a perfect storm, perfect recipe for like, well, I don't have pain right now. I was doing this stuff before. So that's my most like immediate anchor. I'll just go right back to that. But effectively, you are not yet prepared for that. And so that can like put somebody back in this reverberating pathway of, okay, go back to this level of training, have pain, restart the whole thing. And, you know, 6 months down the road, or in this case, 6 years down the road, the person still hasn't, you know, found a return to like unrestricted activity. So when you're talking about increasing the load, there's a number of different ways you can do this, but is there like a progression rate that you think people should abide by, or like how should people approach this?
Yeah, so this is a tricky question, but there's no absolute load kind of increment rate that would be generalizable across people, across tasks. It's going to be a pretty individual thing, and then it's also admittedly going to be completely made up. I've seen this in a lot of folks. We've experienced it both of ourselves as well. I think that it's, again, another phenomenon that's a bit more common among more motivated trainees, and particularly those who've had to pull back a lot. So if you've had to pull back a ton from a previous level of strength, and you're like, gosh, I'm just itching to move those heavy weights again, you know, for both of us, for example, I know that, like, say I've been at my strongest, you know, routinely every week deadlifting into the 600s and 700s. And if I have to pull way back to, you know, pull in the 100s or 200s or something like that, I'm like, man, anything less than 600 feels kind of lame. And I really want to get back to being strong again. That's a very common mindset among, you know, motivated trainees. And so I also think about a comment that I've heard Derek Miles talk about in other contexts, including, you know, muscle strains like hamstring tears from, you know, sprinting too much too soon, or ACL rehab. This phrase that I've heard him say, where he says, you're going to feel ready before you are ready. You're going to feel better before you are better. And that means that a lot of times folks will actually experience pretty significant desensitization in discomfort. But that doesn't mean that they have the all clear to just, as he says, full send to whatever your maximum capacity was in the past. There needs to be some graded progression to that. We've even seen it in scenarios as simple as, like, say somebody's been rehabbing with, you know, and gradually brought their reps down, and they get down to doing sets of five or something like that, and they're like, gosh, I feel great. I'm gonna test out a top single. And they'll do like a projected estimated one rep max and go for, like, you know, they may even back off a tiny bit from that, but they're just not yet ready for singles. They're not prepared for the thing they're trying to do, which is fundamentally what the theme that we've been talking about, matching the training to the person's tolerance, ensuring the tolerance is matched to the training, ensuring the person's prepared to do what they're trying to do, preparing to do the thing you want to do. These are all just different ways of saying the same thing. And I think that a lot of times there's a mismatch there, and that leads to either an incidence of symptoms, a relapse of symptoms, another setback, which can piss people off even more. And so it can be pretty tricky. So that's kind of like the general way that I think about this, and the scenarios where I feel like we've seen it the most. And then when I'm incrementing with somebody, it kind of, especially for people where I've had to pull back a lot up front. So say I have anybody who's, you know, moderately strong, and I have to pull them way back to where they're doing tempo squats with, I don't know, 80 pounds or something like that. Like, not very much for a well-trained person. In the early phase, I'm actually very conservative with their rate of load increase. And I might either set load caps of, for this session, we're not going to go heavier than this weight if you feel good, but feel free to do less. I might give a percent increment. That's again, a cap, do no more than this. Feel free to do less if you feel okay. Or RPE caps or something like that. Still with a way that I'm like tugging pretty hard on the reins to prevent somebody from going too far. But if they if they start to string together session after session after session that are good and they're incrementing and feeling better and better and better, then I will probably start to liberalize that load increment a little bit more to where they're able to take slightly bigger jumps. Not only do I think that that's likely to be safe, even if they have a little bit of some, you know, fluctuating ache and pain along the way, but it also gets them excited, motivated. They can, you know, see the progress. They can feel, you know, maybe some acceleration, although it is controlled acceleration in terms of their rehab. But that's not always feasible either. Sometimes we have to be super slow and methodical and gradual. And so it's a really individualized type thing. But I think that some form of a cap or a ceiling is often necessary for the motivated trainee because of how often, you know, people are likely to go off the reservation in this process.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when you're generally setting this up, I think one maybe idea or concept is this idea of like movement regression, right? So if there's a unrestricted movement, let's call it like a squat, normal tempo, you know, low reps, heavy weights, whatever, you can incrementally regress that with a number of different features in the programming. So the first one would be tempo. You can add a tempo component, weight on the bar goes down. You can adjust the range of motion, which alters the weight that you can use. You can change the implement. The weight on the bar will subsequently change due to either familiarity, mechanical advantage, and so on. The rep scheme, if you increase the reps, the weight on the bar is going to go down. Proximity to failure, so like RPE or RIR, the further away you get from failure, the lower the weight on the bar is. All of these things will, you know, ordain a change in the weight that you lift. So that's kind of where you start. But then as someone goes week by week, the idea is to again, progress them by removing some of these sort of features. So a tempo 303 tempo squat done for 12 reps at RP6 moves to like a 300 tempo squat for 12 reps at RP6. And then it's a normal tempo squat for 12 reps at RP6. And then it's 10 reps at RP6, normal, you know, and you just keep going. And so that will allow somebody to add weight when these things change. But to your point, having a load cap in there can be useful. Like, look, we've allowed you to potentially lift more weight, but I'm only going to let you lift 10% more weight or 20 pounds. So you can use discrete weights, you can use percentages. And again, these are all made up, but the idea is that you're kind of giving somebody a hard stop to like, this is as far as I'll let you go based on the expectation that they should be able to tolerate that. And you're being conservative here. So this is kind of a flip from my initial stance of being aggressive, like when somebody just reports, hey, I got this thing going on, to now I'm being more conservative. If again, we've bit the bullet, we're doing this rehab stuff. And once we're in that, I kind of stay conservative until I have ample proof that the person is ready to go forward. So that's kind of a linear progression model. You know, you drop the reps, weight goes up. You can also increase the weight on the bar with the same reps. You know, as the sensitivity goes down, if the tempo is kind of tempo component is removed, you can lift more weight. And so that would be like a linear progression type model. You can use a double progression type model as well, where instead of it just being 12 reps at RP6, let's call it 10 to 15 reps at RP6. And so week one, hey, I want you to do 10 reps. That's it at RP6. And then next week, I want you to keep the weight the same and try to get another rep if you can, if you feel fine. So you can do stuff like that. Once they get to 15 reps at that point, they're like, huh, I've got enough time, you know, you've demonstrated enough capacity here where I can either increase the weight, you can either increase the weight again, or we can drop the rep range. Now, instead of 10 to 15, it's 8 to 12. And you can kind of migrate that down to somebody's preferred sort of training level. And I'll add on a piece here. Even if someone has no desire to go to a powerlifting meet, to test a 1RM, one rep max, for example, I still want them to have unrestricted training if they should want. And so I will probably push that person eventually down into the 3 to 5 rep range just so they can tolerate it. Not because I think that's the best way to support their, you know, lifetime goals or whatever, but I just think having unrestricted capacity for movement is probably the end goal here. But the whole time we're really trying to develop tolerance for this quote, full recovery to unrestricted movement. That's work capacity. So how much volume can you tolerate? Power, so speed, How quickly can you move? That's another sort of non-pain related finding. So some people they'll add weight to the bar and then the movement itself slows way down. It's like this sort of kinesophobia playing out before your life. They're afraid of the movement. And you might ask, hey, do you have pain? Like, is everything okay? And they're like, no, I'm fine. It's like, yeah, but you slowed down. That's sort of a mental confidence sort mm-hmm. of situation of fear. And that kind of indicates to me that maybe we're progressing a little too quickly for how the person is sort of unlearning that pain loop that they were kind of involved in. And there's more stuff here, but you really need to develop tolerance back to what the person needs in order to progress further for their stated goals. So again, back to our original example, let's say the original workout was 5 sets of 5 at RP 7. Person gets down, they've done this rehab plan, they started with tempo squats, 12 reps, you know, whatever, and they've worked their way down. Now they're doing normal tempo squats, 5 reps at RP7 for 2 sets. You cannot just jump from there to 5 sets, right? We need to build that work capacity, that tolerance back up. And so is it adding one more set? Maybe. Is it adding one more set that's a back off set, 10% lighter than what you were doing? There are many different ways to do this. But I just having that idea in the back of your mind, whether you're a fitness professional or healthcare professional or just a, you know, strength enthusiast kind of DIY in this on your own, it's gradual progression to get back to where you were that ultimately supports your ability to train productively. It's very similar to the progressive loading thing in every single way. You know, that's as best I can explain it.
Yeah, I think that when I have these conversations, sometimes it's necessary to actually address that progressive loading concept that we've talked about in the past, because there are some folks who are of the belief that building strength is what will make my pain go away. And that is not accurate for the most part. It is not that you have pain because a certain muscle is weak or an area is weak. That is by and large not a valid concept for the vast majority of these sorts of situations. And so we've talked before this concept of progressive loading such that you do not add weight to the bar in order to drive strength adaptations, but rather as you accrue strength adaptations, you are then able to add weight to the bar. There's kind of a similar concept that you can apply here, where it is not that we're increasing weight in order to make your pain go away or increasing weight to get you stronger to make your pain go away, but rather that, you know, as things desensitize, as the pain improves and your tolerance increases, you will then be able to add weight to the bar. And if you fully adopt this kind of mental framework of how this process works, then honestly, going through rehab gets a lot easier, because then you start to notice that if you're accelerating the load increases too quickly and things are getting worse, it's obvious that, hey, things are not calming down as quickly as I'm trying to load them, right? Rather, as things calm down, I will be able to load them. And then that kind of almost logically leads to the necessary rate of progression, type of progression, et cetera. So difficult concept for a lot of folks to get their mind around, particularly if they come from an older school mentality of training where you must add weight to the bar to force strength increases. The idea that that pain is because you're weak or something like that, and getting stronger will make your pain go away. Well, if that's the case, then you know no powerlifter, no weightlifter, no strongman would ever have a non-traumatic ache or pain or injury, because they're pretty strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, not the case. Can't confirm. Okay. So the first two mistakes that people make were mostly load related. When we come back after this break, we're going to talk about the third common mistake that people make during the rehab, just not varying the movement enough. For all the golfers in the audience, you've probably heard of PXG by seeing them on the PGA Tour in the hands of guys like Joel Damon, Zach Johnson, and Luke List. Well, they're bringing that same passion for excellence to their new line of apparel, and I gotta say, they nailed it. I just got another polo from them, and both the fit and performance are excellent. They're really versatile as well, meaning I can wear them out to eat or take a meeting without signaling to everyone that I'm about to play golf. PXG apparel has something for everyone. They got pants, polos, sweaters, hats, quarter zips, joggers, jackets, skirts, everything you could want. I've got a few of their hats and a few of their polos, but some of their mid layers look great too. We've got a special offer for our audience. If you're looking to elevate your style game on and off the course, check out the PXG Spring and Summer 2024 collections. Head over to pxg.com/barbell and use the code barbell at checkout to save 10% on all apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. That's code BARBELL. To save 10% on apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of my questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
All right, we're back here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Three most common mistakes people make during rehab. The last one here is not varying the movement enough. And I think you could even expand this to further say, like, just not being open to changing the movement enough or movements that are selected enough. This is generally people who are involved in some sort of barbell sport and they have their pet movements. If they're a powerlifter, it's SBD. If they're an Olympic weightlifter, it's, you know, the clean and jerk and the snatch or variations thereof, maybe the front squat. And it's like, well, I got to do these movements. This is who I am. This is not only my identity, but it's my sport. So, like, if I can do these movements any way, shape, or form, I'm going to keep doing them. And the point here is that, well, I would probably allow that, at least on some level, if somebody did not have any of those, you know, pain-related symptoms. It didn't get worse as they added weight, for example. They didn't have symptoms after the training session. And then we were able to find an entry point with those movements. Look, you can keep squat, benching, and deadlifting. Great. You can keep doing the clean and jerk and the snatch on some level, some weight. Great. I'm probably going to keep that in the program unless it is setting you back, as demonstrated by some of those signs and symptoms that we talked about. However, I am highly likely, in fact, almost certainly, going to liberalize the other movements instead of it just being all squats, all benches, all deadlifts to different variations, whether it's machine-based, whether there's their unilateral or isolation type stuff to like directly target that area. The idea is that I want to make sure that that sensitivity in that area is much lower, likely even better than what it was beforehand. And while also maybe giving that area time to cool off without additional loading. So in a perfect world, I would squat 3 or 4 times a week. I would deadlift, you know, 2 to 3 times a week. I would bench 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 times a week, whatever, in a perfect world. But in a rehab setting, I might do like a, you know, no shit squat, bench press, or deadlift once a week at a slightly different rep range, you know, or maybe markedly different rep range, potentially with the tempo component, potentially with the altered range of motion. And then the rest of the program are going to be variations of those movements that are likely even lighter still or regressed further. So instead of just a, you know, bilateral back squat, it might be a dumbbell split squat, tempo split squat, box step ups, you know, leg press, for example, leg extensions, leg curl, whatever. You know, you can see how I'm just liberalizing my movement selection to not only, again, directly target the area, desensitize it, but also reduce some of the total training load that I'm being exposed to in an effort to recapture my sort of training tolerance, allow the area to cool down, and ultimately return to find the entry point for the return to unrestricted sort of function.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily even frame it as reducing the training load, but rather redistributing it. Because, you know, a lot of people are still capable of doing a lot of training and maintaining a lot of fitness, sometimes even building fitness. I mean, myself, I think you, our whole rehab team have plenty of stories of people who have PR'd during rehab phases, PR'd all sorts of other things. But you can maintain, build a lot of fitness by just redistributing the workload, redistributing the stress across the body in different ways. And so I similarly am super liberal with doing all sorts of weird things. Derek sometimes has a competition to find the weirdest movement he can convince the person to do, or to make them look the silliest when they record their exercises. And that can extend also beyond if somebody is, you know, habitually very strength focused, but they're far enough away from a planned competition or anything like that, even outside of gym type activities, getting people to do various other sorts of, you know, life activities, conditioning modalities, go take a hike, go try to swim, go play some pickleball or something like that. I don't know. There's just a lot of ways to get people moving differently to facilitate things desensitizing, calming things down, building fitness in other new ways. I mean, if you want to frame it as, hey, we're getting you into great shape so that when this is all calmed down and you're ready to get back to training, you'll be able to tolerate it better than ever. And most of the people that we've worked with are able to come back and exceed their previous PRs anyway. So it's more so a matter of like, are you willing to spend the time and do what's necessary to get there? Or are you going to keep digging your heels in and refusing to do what's necessary?
Yeah, it's definitely an opportunity to improve overall fitness and preparedness for a dedicated sort of training program. Like even if you're a power lifter, like, yeah, maybe some exposure to unilateral work, isolation work, more conditioning, that just makes you a better athlete so that later when you're able to tolerate a, you know, traditional powerlifting program, as it were, you're in a better place to do it from and go from there. It also gives people an opportunity to work hard in a different movement that, you know, has a low likelihood of exacerbating symptoms, right? So you have this person with knee pain and they're like, man, I can't really squat heavy. Can't really, you know, deadlift heavy. And what do I do? I really just want to push some heavy weight. How do I do it? And it's like, yeah, we could probably load you up on a hip thrust. We could probably load you up on like a lying leg curl. We could, yeah. For a conditioning thing, we could probably figure out a way to do farmer's walks, for example, you know, sled drags. Are heavy and you could just, you know, strap the thing around your waist and pull it, for example. Obviously, people have different sort of sensitivities with different movements. And so this isn't a prescriptive sort of idea, just more so thinking outside the box for like, what can people tolerate? What allows them to work hard and what maybe would improve their overall fitness? And as you said, redistribute the total training load. That's probably one of the bigger mistakes we see with the rehab world at large, is that when people do enter a quote, you know, formal rehab phase, the total training stress is much lower than the person needs to not only maintain their current fitness levels, but also potentially improve them. It's like, this person's got knee pain, so they can't do any lower body exercises, or the lower body exercises that they do are not very challenging, way reduced sort of training stress. And oh, by the way, we're not going to like compensate for that by programming anything else that they can do right now to sort of make up for that lack of sort of training stress. So there are many different ways to sort of vary the movement. When we think about upper body based exercises, modifying the grip, one way just right off the bat. So if somebody has symptomatic sort of shoulder sensitivity when they bench press with their normal grip, well, you could go narrower, you could go wider. For example, you could change the angle, you could go to an incline bench, decline bench, for example, switch to overhead press. If it's a lower body exercise, changing the stance, right? So like a wide stance squat or narrow stance squat, something like that. Same thing on a deadlift. If you're somebody who always pulls conventional, they could start doing some sumo stuff. Bar placement is another big one, particularly for like the squat. Switching from high bar to low bar, or low bar to high bar, or low or high bar to front squat. Even Zercher squats, programmed that before. You can change the implement. If benching with the straight bar always causes pain, you could switch to dumbbells. Maybe that's easier way to get it, you know, to easier entry point. Could use a Swiss bar, could use a machine. You can switch to unilateral stuff. This is particularly useful for folks who are immobilized, have some sort of immobilization, right? They're like, well, I hurt my right elbow. I'm in like a, you know, a sling or cast or, you know, brace or something like that. Well, what about the other arm? You can still do stuff with that. Oh, God,
I had this. I use a lot of unilateral work in rehab contexts and all sorts of silly seeming unilateral movements to people who are like, you know, very blinders on powerlifting, you know, training mode. I do a lot of unilateral work and find that to be super useful to help people, again, feel like they're training hard, working hard, get a pump going, develop some new, you know, athleticism, sometimes even some unilateral and ballistic plyo type stuff, single leg jumps, all sorts of other things, just like new, getting people moving in new and different ways is the idea. And as you are enumerating, there are near endless ways to do that. It's just convincing somebody or going through this behavior change process, getting somebody who is a, who's an SBD for life person to be willing to, you know, expand the envelope a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just different ways to achieve the desired fitness adaptations. And again, preparing you to be a better athlete, a better lifter, have more physical development for the time when you can train in an unrestricted fashion. We're just filling in those holes that may have developed over, you know, the course of your career so far. So the next question before we wrap this up, final question is, well, when do you start to reduce variation, right? So let's say, you know, somebody's entry level plant rehab plan involves marked variation. Every movement's different. You only squat maybe once a week, or you know, a compound squat type pattern. Again, whether it's a back squat, front squat, leg press, whatever, that's your compound thing. And then you, every other squat slot, as it were, is machine based, for example. Well, when do you start to pivot back, and like, how gradual do you do that? Do you have a good rule of thumb for that?
Yeah, this would be just a step down sort of process of stepping the variation back down towards less and less over time, but only if it is consistent with the person's goals. And so this involves a conversation with the person of like, why are we training? What are you doing? And if they're like, well, I just like to be healthy, I don't know that we need to markedly reduce the variation, because as we've talked about at length in other podcasts and elsewhere, there is no magic health benefit of doing a barbell squat versus any other type of, you know, loaded activity generally matched for the amount of muscle mass and volume that is being trained, right? So I don't have a reason to want to make you squat three times a week if that is not something specifically that you are have a performance oriented goal for or a strong preference for. And so that's the first thing I'm assessing is like, why are you training? What do you want to accomplish? General health? Cool. I'm probably not reducing variation, honestly, all that much at all, unless it's more of a convenience thing. Like, it's really a pain for me to go to this gym and use these different pieces of equipment, whatever the case is. But if they can maintain high variation, I'm all for it. That's great. If they say I have a strong preference for these particular movements, then I will gradually, probably over a process of weeks to more so months, gradually adjust some slots kind of one at a time back towards more specific movements. But I may still make them slightly different to where somebody is doing a low bar squat and a high bar squat and a SSB or a front squat or something like that, if that's something they're interested in. But, and then finally, if they're saying, well, I'm a competitor and I compete in this particular movement, then yeah, I know that I'm going to need to get a fair amount of, you know, weekly training specificity on that activity. And so that's ultimately where I'm going to need to go. But that doesn't mean I need to eliminate other variation. Those just might take secondary or tertiary training slots throughout the week. So I have plenty of competitive, you know, lifters who are still doing, you know, split squats or step ups or Cossack squats or lateral lunges or single leg extensions or leg presses, but they're just relegated to secondary, tertiary, or like end of session type slots. And the thinking there is that I'm just maintaining the capacity that I have built up in the rehab phase, and keeping them moving in new and different ways. Maybe, you know, I could make a case that maybe I'm reducing the risk of some sort of, you know, overuse syndrome compared to piling all of that equivalent volume onto the main movements. That's just a hypothesis, but rather still distributing it across the body in a different way. So that's kind of my approach to this kind of thing. Really just depends on what's the person's intent and goals with their training as to whether I need to reduce it at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like if you have a person who's training, who's lifting 4 days a week, three exercises per day, you can split that up a number of different ways, but I'll just give you guys like a 10,000 foot view of how I think about this. That's 12 different movement slots. And the way that I split that up most of the time is an equal distribution between lower body and upper body. So there'd be three squat pattern type slots. There'd be three hinge pattern type slots. There'd be six upper body type slots, usually half of those dedicated to upper body pressing and half dedicated to upper body pulling. Those are my four major archetypes: squat, hinge, press, pull. Now you can redistribute some of those depending on the person's preferences, their needs, et cetera, but that's kind of a general landscape of how I think about programming over the course of a week. And all of those variations are different from each other, meaning that the three squat slots are not the same. One might be a normal back squat, for example. The other one might be a pause squat or tempo squat or safety squat, bar squat, or leg press, whatever. And the third one is a unilateral type squat, split squat, box step ups, something like that. Same thing on the deadlift. You could have a regular deadlift for one movement, an RDL for another movement, hip thrust, you know, single leg hip thrust for another movement, lying leg curl, single leg lying leg curl, Nordic hamstring curl, whatever for the other movement. And so as far as when I would reduce that to get like more specific, to your point, if it's like a general strength conditioning client, probably never, unless they want to test a 1RM, they're going to a powerlifting meet where they really want to like focus on their, you know, squat, bench, deadlift, strength, something like that. Otherwise, I'm maintaining the variation unless I have a good reason to not maintain that variation. For the strength athlete, I still maintain that level of variation. It's just the variance, like the different variations get more and more constrained instead of the, you know, secondary squat slot potentially being like a leg press. Well, all right, these are all going to be, you know, barbell bilateral exercises, maybe with the pause, maybe with pins, maybe to a box, maybe with, you know, safety squat bar, but it's still pretty similar to the regular squat. Same thing on the deadlift. It's instead of it being, you know, a hip thrust potentially, it's probably going to be with a barbell, RDL, for example, stiff legged deadlift, just because that's more specific to the deadlift. But that is for a relatively short period of time and in a population of folks who are, you know, need to get their one rep max strength up, or that's their particular preference. Otherwise, I kind of maintain that variation. And I think if I was a betting man, which I'm not just yet, but maybe in my later age, I will start gambling, maybe develop a gambling problem. We can then do a podcast on gambling problems. But if I had to bet, I do think increasing the variation is likely a way or a hedge against developing overuse injuries while also fully developing, or at least more fully developing, somebody's sort of physical capacity to do a bunch of different movements, have proficiency in a bunch of different movements, a bunch of different rep ranges, and ultimately kind of build that big base of physical development that we want them to see, that they can then apply specifically later on. That's kind of my overall thought process here.
Yeah, I agree. I think both your and my own training in recent year, what's been years at this point, but has a lot more variation than it did, I don't know, a decade ago or something like that. So definitely an evolution there.
Yeah, it is interesting. I did this podcast with Mike Tuchera and the RTS guys, maybe 2 years ago now at this point. And when I think about like long-term development within barbell sports, you know, how I would start it, like this person who says, oh, I'm a new powerlifter. I'm like, oh, great. Like, how long have you been training for powerlifting? And they're like, 0 months. You're like, okay, so you're just a new lifter. Mm-hmm. Who is interested in powerlifting. That's interesting on how you got involved in that, but let's do it. At the beginning, the variation is high. There's like the wide amount of variation in all these movements, again, trying to build that big base of general physical development. And then it starts to narrow as they get more involved in competing, right? They've got 3 meets a year, and so you're pretty much doing SBD year-round, and they see continued progress from that just because they're pretty early on in their sort of development, right? But at some point, that tends to plateau. And if you go into open powerlifting or any sort of one of these databases that has results on powerlifters, you see this like kind of arc. And they improve, they improve, they improve, and then they plateau. And I think that that's generally sort of in the what I would call the middle of people's career if they continue on after that, or it's the end of somebody's career because they're like, look, I'm not getting any better. Like, I don't know what the deal is. Injuries start to pile up, life happens, and they kind of get out of the sport. At that point, you almost have to re-liberalize, re-expand sort of movement selection because holes have developed in your fitness on the way to that point. And so now the stuff that worked before, this kind of specialization that led you to where you're at right now, it no longer works. So you have to kind of re-expand the movement selection. But doing that, man, that takes a lot of like a
mental
lot of guts.
Reprogramming. Yeah.
Totally. Because you're like, well, this thing got me here. You're telling me to change what got me here. And just as a personal example, and this is N=1, I'm not saying this is, you know, the same trajectory everyone else is gonna follow, but like I went from a 1,300-pound total in 2012 to a 1,795 total in 2014, right? Primarily just doing squat, bench, and deadlift. I gained muscle, whatever. I'm on top of the world. I'm like, wow, all I have to do for the rest of my time on this planet to get to, you know, an 1820 total or a 1900 pound total is just keep doing the same things that got me here. It took me, 9 years to beat that 1795 total. Because, you know, there were 3 or 4 years of like limited training resources plus not so great programming with just pretty specific stuff. And then upon figuring out like, I probably need to re-expand, I had to fill in all these gaps in my fitness, plus get lucky that my performance was all higher on a particular day. So I think that that sort of arc is what a lot of people listening to this are probably going through. And they're, you know, again, to your point, mentally reprogramming themselves that like, I need something different than what got me here. It's not a big stretch. I think once you hear it, you're like, that makes some sense, or at least I'm more open to that than before. But if you never heard that advice and you're just kind of toiling along on your own, like I was for years and years and years, well, that is not a steep learning curve. That is a flat learning curve.
Yeah, I'm gonna leave that one alone.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, well, let's wrap this up. Austin, this is like your closing thoughts, Jerry's Corner at the end of the Jerry Springer Show. What do you want to leave people with?
Yeah, so the big picture way we think about this kind of situation of non-traumatic aches and pains in the gym is that there's at some point likely been a mismatch between the training stimulus. Usually we think about that in terms of the dosage, oftentimes intensity related, sometimes the combination of intensity and volume. So a mismatch between that training stimulus dosage and your tolerance at that particular time, which can fluctuate, ebb and flow based on life circumstances, sleep, stress, all sorts of other things. When we're working through this kind of rehab process or trying to manage these sorts of aches and pains, we really want to bring those variables into better alignment. This will allow things to cool off, thing number one, and build tolerance back towards being able to do what you want to do. That's thing number two. There are three common mistakes that motivated trainees make when they're attempting to work through pain and injury. Those are the three mistakes we talked about today. So motivated trainees oftentimes do not reduce the load nearly enough early on in this phase to get below a symptom threshold from which they can build. If they do, they oftentimes will re-increase the load too quickly, particularly if they start to feel better. They will put their foot on the gas and accelerate too quickly back towards normal training instead of maintaining a conservative, kind of capped, measured, gradual process. Or finally, if they have been training with a degree of specificity, meaning similar exercises most of the time, for example, if it's a squat, bench, deadlift type person, or if it was a weightlifter just doing snatches and clean and jerks or whatever else, not incorporating enough movement variation. And that doesn't just mean, you know, going from a low bar squat to a high bar squat, but going way out to left field is really valuable early on from a mental standpoint, from a physical standpoint to facilitate this rehab process. And so hammering away at the same sensitive movement patterns, not pulling back the weight enough, increasing the load too quickly, those are all common mistakes. Whereas what we would do is we would oftentimes pull people back more than they want to, progress them slower than they want to, especially early on. And number three, widen the base of movement variation that they do well beyond their, you know, chosen implement of choice if it's a barbell. So they might go to machine movements, kettlebell, dumbbell, unilateral stuff, more conditioning-based exercises, more isolation-type work, finding ways to get them moving in novel, different ways, both for building fitness, for enjoyment in new and different ways, for new PRs on all sorts of new activities, for getting a solid pump. There's a lot of things to be celebrated in that process. So we try to help people find an appropriate entry point to activity by monitoring things like what are their symptoms during the session? What are their symptoms after the session when they're lying down to go to sleep at night? Are they having a persistent ache and throb? Is the pain persistent until their next session, or does it actually get better? Those are all variables that we look at to say, are we at our entry point? Are we below this tolerable symptom threshold, or are we still above it and we need to change things more? And then once we get to that entry point, we need to progress things both conservatively, but also reactively. In other words, adjusting that progression in response to what the person is experiencing. This can be done with things like autoregulation, RPE, but also just subjective feedback, putting load caps or load target ranges. You mentioned the concept of double progression, which we have some content on our website, various strategies to kind of keep people within the guardrails of a tolerable, you know, range of symptoms throughout the process, but also being open to if we're not making progress, we might need to just pull something out of the program altogether for a period of time. That could be a few days, could be a couple of weeks before kind of re-challenging it again and seeing if we can get things back on track. And then lastly, I'll say that it's important to recognize that this process works not in the way that people traditionally think about building strength, where you add weight and that makes you stronger, but rather we get stronger as a result of effectively programmed training and recovery. And as a result, we're able to add weight. The same concepts apply here. If you are dealing with pain and we're doing the right things to facilitate that pain cooling off, calming down, then as a result, we will be able to increment the load on the next session. It should not be viewed as the way I'm going to make my pain go down is increasing the weight because that's going to make me stronger and strength makes pain go away, because that's false. And I would not listen to anybody who makes such claims. So I think that's my overall summary.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And we have a lot of resources available. We have the article that Dr. Baraki wrote on this, in addition to other articles about pain and training and how to handle specific issues. We have stuff on hips, on knees, on low back pain, sciatica, et cetera, all on the website. We also have templates to address very common areas of pain. So whether that's in your knee, your low back, your shoulders, we have templates to guide you through that. So you don't have to do it yourself. You can get a free week of it if you get on our app, search Barbell Medicine in the Apple app store. You can get the 1 week for free if you need an entry point guided by us. And if none of that stuff works for you, you need some more help, have a more specific case, requires some additional sort of level of expertise, well, we do consults and coaching with our team of excellent rehab professionals. So those are available for you as well. You can contact us through the website. But I think that wraps up this podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening on the most common rehab mistakes that people make. Shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for spending time with us and for writing the article. But before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.